I think we have about 20. If I think we should go ahead and get started. There's a good amount to get through. Good afternoon, everyone. This is our Rover session on the management of liver lesions. We have a great panel with us today from a variety of different specialties. To introduce them all, starting from left to right on the screen, first we have Dr. Shamar Young. He's an interventional radiologist at the University of Arizona. We have Dr. Nima Nababizadeh, who's a radiation oncologist at OHSU. Dr. Daniel Chang, who is also a radiation oncologist at the University of Michigan and chair of a department there. And Dr. Marshall Baker, who's a surgical oncologist with us from Loyola. And my understanding is soon to be University of Utah. So we can go ahead and get started. Let's see. Next, that's just myself, a resident in radiation oncology from UNC. So our first presenter will be Dr. Marshall Baker, again, a surgical oncologist. And we'll get started with his first case. Dr. Baker.
Thanks very much for that introduction. You know, I wasn't exactly sure if this was interactive. So I kind of left it a little bit with the potential to be that. But if we're just running through it, you know, just let me know and I can kind of make it move a little bit more quickly. But the first case, I got two cases where I think we were supposed to put one together, but I couldn't help myself. I mean, I love this stuff. And it just kind of, there's just a lot of, I think, really cool liver tumor, great pictures to share with you guys. But the first one is a 49-year-old female who had a past medical history for biliary cirrhosis, primary biliary cholangitis, but she had had pretty spotty follow-up over the course of her lifetime, and at one point just presented to a primary care physician with increased right atrial. She was volunteering and had been active through most of her life, and her abdominal exam was completely normal. She had no evidence of ascites and no evidence of any liver insufficiency at that time. So her primary care doctor got some basic blood work for her, which you kind of see here. Nothing really too remarkable. I mean, normal platelet count, normal kidney function, relatively normal bilirubin for PBC type patient. And then went ahead and got some imaging. And I think she actually had a CT scan first in the primary care office, went from that to this MRI, which demonstrated a relatively large tumor in the right hepatic lobe that had arterial enhancing features with some central hypo enhancement with a heterogeneous mass that didn't have a, I think, classic picture for one specific tumor type or another, but didn't look like anything that was benign. So it looked like a malignant appearing tumor, but wasn't really specific for hepatoma or any of the tumor types you kind of typically see. Let's go one more slide forward. So the questions are, I think, when you see a case like this, you know, what's our differential diagnosis? What do we think we need for further workup? What kind of therapeutic options should we be considering? And, you know, I kind of would stop here and let people give opinions. But if we want to kind of move through the cases, I can keep going from here.
Yeah, we can do that. You know, the panelists can certainly comment too. And none of the attendees have the ability to speak, but some people will leave questions in the chat for us or comments there. But
the patient didn't look like they had cirrhosis on just like that one picture of MRI. Just out of curiosity, do they have a history of cirrhosis at all? I think you may be muted, Dr. Baker.
Sorry. She had had PBC, but no cirrhosis. So, but she had a couple of visits to a hepatologist early in life, but nothing really that was too remarkable for symptoms and sort of dropped off the radar screen. So she hadn't been getting really any surveillance and really hadn't had any biopsies or fibro scans or MRI elastography or anything like that. But I agree, the MRI
she got that first presentation did not look.
I think you're having a hard time hearing you, Dr. Baker. It looks like there's might be a service issue.
Okay. Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Doesn't that look like cirrhosis? No.
Okay. All right, so let's go ahead and advance through these.
Okay, so you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so we ended up doing what we normally do. And I mean, the differential diagnosis I think is broad, but in these tumors that appear malignant, I mean, you gotta be thinking of both primary liver tumors, such as HCC, cholangiocarcinoma, and also metastatic lesions. So we normally start with two markers, all of which, usually includes CEA, AFT, and CA19-9, and usually a chromogranin A level. The CEA19-9 was elevated at 205. The other markers were normal. We usually get colonoscopy and chest imaging. The colonoscopy was negative, and the chest imaging was also negative. And so I think the question now is, do we need to do more? Do we need to get a biopsy? Do we need to do additional staging imaging? Or do we just kind of move on to treatment? You know, if there are thoughts from the panel about what to do at this point for her, but relatively normal liver function test, no ascites, no cirrhosis, and elevated CA19-9, and no evidence of metastatic disease on imaging. Would you go ahead and biopsy this?
All you've had so far, sorry, was a MR of the abdomen and a chest CT?
Yeah, MR abdomen, chest CT, colonoscopy is negative, and a CA19-9 of 205. With a 12 centimeter solid lesion, the right hepatic lobe.
I mean, I guess if you're thinking like cholangio or something because of that elevated C99, I mean, I just wonder if a PET scan would be useful, but otherwise I'd probably biopsy just because obviously, unless you're really take it to surgery, but obviously the pathology will have implications. So I'd probably be thinking biopsy.
Yeah, I would. I think we would probably advocate for biopsy of this lesion, both to kind of make sure we know what we're dealing with, and also depending on what it showed, see if there were any actionable mutations, etc.
My question would be based on that initial imaging: is this somebody who you would deem surgically resectable right now, or are there concerns that that might not be the case?
Yeah, I think she would be somebody we would think of as being surgically resectable up front, but it's a little bit hard to estimate perfectly, I think, just based on the size of the tumor location and the fact that she's got the primary biliary cholangitis and might have some underlying liver disease that we need to be known about for a long time. It's interesting. I feel you could probably do all of it. You could take her to surgery now, or you could biopsy it and kind of consider therapeutic options from there. We decided, because there was some concern that she might have had a longer course with the PVC and might have more scarring in the liver, to go ahead and do the biopsy. And the biopsy came back consistent with cholangiocarcinoma. And so then I think the next question is, what are therapeutic options? I think if you want to advance the slide next. And I think we did this. I feel like I'm one slide ahead of where I wanted to be, but can you go to the next one? Yeah. So I think when you're thinking about what to do for these with no evidence of distant metastatic disease, there are a whole bunch of options. And the panel, I think, is here to kind of discuss all of those. But resection, destination catheter-based therapy, external radiation liver transplants are the ones that are on the list. And I think for this younger person without any distant disease and no, cholangiocarcinoma is the pathology, I think you're thinking resection as the best upfront option. And then we start talking about whether or not they've got enough functional liver reserve in their remnant to really be a good candidate for resection. So if you want to go back a slide, we did some volumetric studies for her. Go back one. Sorry, I think I just put them out of order. And these are some of the volumetric studies that we initially got. So in blue, I think you're looking at her right lobe. And in orange, you're looking at the medial segment of the left lobe. And in pink there, you're looking at the left lateral section. And our calculation initially was about 25% to get a negative margin, which I think for her would have probably meant taking part of segment four. And I felt like that was a number that was a little bit low given her in her PBC. And so we look at that and we're like, well, she's probably going to do okay with a resection, but her functional volume seems a little bit on the low side. So what do you do with that? If you could go ahead and advance the slide from there. And so what we elected to do is to give her some treatment up front with catheter-based therapy, which in this case was to, you know, allow the left segments to hypertrophy and potentially kill the tumor to some degree, make it a little bit easier to get a margin negative resection. And if you look at that picture, you can see how big the left lateral segment kind of became. It kind of wraps around the posterior aspect of the spleen on the left side there. And the tumor has gone from being one which has a significant amount of peripheral enhancement and tumor viability on pre-treatment scans to one that looks nearly completely dead based on Y90 treatment at about 6 months. Go ahead, another slide.
Can I just ask a quick question? Do you know if you're, so there's from an IR specific perspective, there's kind of a couple ways you could treat that lesion. You can treat with something that they call radiation lobectomy. And basically the goal there is really just to get hypertrophy. And then you happen to get, you know, whatever tumor killing you get that as well. Another way to do it, which I think, you know, definitely we want to damage some of the normal liver to get you that hypertrophy you're looking for resection. Another way to do it is something called boost dosing, where you know, treat the liver the lesion specifically, and then pull back to get the radiation lobectomy and kind of treat the normal tissue. Just out of curiosity, do you happen to know which way they went there?
Yeah, the guys that we work with tend to try to do a selective embolization. And so it's not usually just the tumor, but it's tumor in some surrounding liver parenchyma, but it's not a lobectomy. So, you know, in small tumors, I try to do sort of a radiation segmentectomy. In this larger tumor, which kind of covers a few segments, they'll do something more than that, but less than a lobectomy. And I think if you go back a slide, you can kind of see that, you know, there isn't, I feel like, a lot of destruction of the right hepatic lobe. You're actually, I think, seeing some hypertrophy in the inferior aspects of that right lobe and right posterior sector. But the tumor itself is dead. So it's sort of a selective embolization of the tumor plus a little bit of margin around it, if that makes sense. And so when you see post-treatment, and this is going to be something where we subtract the tumor volume from the volume of the right lobe to kind of get this measurement, but your functional liver volume has gone up about 30%. And it kind of feels like we're going to do a little better in terms of getting her through the surgery following this treatment. So you can go ahead and another slide. So this is, you know, basically the second two bullets. You get persistent uptake at the various locations in the tumor, suggesting there's still a little bit of tumor viability, but the yttrium has resulted in a significant amount of left lobe hypertrophy. And, you know, you still have, I think, similar therapeutic options. I mean, we kind of stop here, where we could do repeat catheter-directed therapy, or we could go ahead with resection. And I think, you know, given the fact she's got no metastatic disease, relatively young person with decent liver function, we opted, and cholangiocarcinoma as a diagnosis, we opted to go ahead with resection. So go ahead one slide. And these are just some pictures from the operation. So you can kind of see, this is a mini lap So it was a laparoscopic assisted mobilization right lobe and then a mini laparotomy. And if you look over on the slide to the left there, you can kind of see this white shiny area in the liver just to the right of the medial segment of the left lobe. And that's treatment effect from the Y90 and sort of tumor all mixed in together. And then you see relatively normal medial segment left lobe, and you see the falciform ligament, and you can kind of get a peek at the left lateral segment. And on the right picture, you can see the cut edge of the liver after that right extended right epiphectomy was done. You can go ahead one more. And so the final path, the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma with negative margins, there was viable tumor. I don't have the percent necrosis, but there was significant radiation effect. And you can kind of see that on the gross pictures over there on the right, where you see this big white discoloration in significant amount of the liver parenchyma surrounding the tumor. And she did very well. I mean, she really had a short hospital stay with almost no changes in her liver function tests and no post-op liver insufficiency.
I would actually be interested to know the panelists' thoughts on whether or not your centers would put this patient on systemic therapy during that 6 month preoperative period.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of that too. I guess, so I'm actually speaking from the University of Michigan yet, only because I'm only recently there, but my experience with this mostly was informed from my time at Stanford. And I feel like we probably would have talked about systemic therapy, partly because with such a large advanced tumor, I think there's always the concern of micrometastatic systemic disease before doing an aggressive, you know, surgery. So maybe putting them on systemic therapy for a little while, you obviously can get some tumor response there. And then if there's no progression, then you could consider sort of the resection pathway with the Y90 embolization, hypertrophy, followed then by the resection. I feel like that probably would also be something that might be considered.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point for discussion. I think you could also argue the flip side pretty easily, that you kind of don't see anything when you get started and you'd like to watch to see anything show up so that you don't take this out, you know, 6 months later if they have metastatic disease show up somewhere else. But I would say, you know, it will be a discussion we have in our tumor board and folks would come to some kind of consensus on whether or not to treat them at the same time. We've definitely done it both ways. And I think there's an increasing inclination to use systemic therapy with the Y90 at this point. But I think the data is still pretty early on doing that.
Yeah.
So we have one more that's about the same length if you guys want to roll through it, but I'm happy to pass the report.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we should probably advance to the next presenter, I believe is Dr. Chang. If we have time, maybe towards the end, we can come back to that one, but I'll advance to the next case.
Sounds good, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that case.
Here we go.
Yeah. I guess I had one question on that previous case, which was, how was it biopsied? Was it just percutaneously biopsied?
Percutaneous core.
Okay. And then what are the thoughts? Are there any concerns about needle tracks and things like that? Or is it just sort of, you just hope for the best?
I think, I've definitely seen needle track seeding, but it's pretty uncommon. Like in the 15 or 16 years I've been doing this, I think there have been two patients in my own practice that have come back with a needle track recurrence. So it's something that we talk about and worry about. And there's a reason that we don't do biopsies if we really know what the tumor is radiographically. But if there's doubt about it or there's discussion about how we might treat them and we feel like we need definitive diagnosis, we'll go ahead and do it. So I think it is an entity that exists, but it is relatively rare. And I don't think ought to be a reason not to pursue biopsy if you feel like it would help guide your treatment decision making.
Okay. And then similar kind of question about the lap, since you started with the laparoscopy, do you just leave the lap port sites in place or do you resect those?
So there are a couple of the port sites that are in the midline incision that come out, but there's always one over on the right side which stays put. And oftentimes that's the site where we bring a drain out in the end anyway.
So we call it form leg size. And I like the laparoscopic approach to it because it gives you a view of the abdomen without making a big incision, so you can confirm that there's no advanced disease or, you know, any evidence of metastatic disease that we haven't seen on our imaging. It also allows you just to make some additional decision making, you know, and you can mobilize that right lobe and really confirm that you feel comfortable that it's a resectable tumor before you give somebody a big midline incision that's going to have a higher degree of morbidity. So I think it's a nice way of managing these guys.
Great. Okay. Thanks for that. So this is the case that I have. Next slide, please. This is someone I saw very recently who actually is just starting treatment. So I don't have a follow-up slide to tell you how she did. It's a 58-year-old female, type 2 diabetes, history of hepatitis C with cirrhosis, and presents to the ER with abdominal pain, found to have an initial hemoglobin of 6.1. Based on a CT, there was concern of blood products, had a CT angio of the abdomen showing a 4-centimeter hyper attenuating lesion in the segment segment 5 with ascites fluid that was that underwent a tap revealing blood. And so the patient was diagnosed with a ruptured HCC resulting in hemoperitoneum. Next slide. And so this, I think if you hit the button, the animation will show up. There's like a little, just point out where the lesion is. So the MR hasn't been gotten yet, but I just put it all on one slide just so you can see, but you can clearly see there's this on the left, the screen left is the initial CT. You can see the ascites associated with it. And then on the MR, which was done a little bit down the road, the ascites had resolved. Next slide. So the patient underwent a hemostatic transarterial chemoembolization, but due to multiple parasitized blood vessels, only 50% of embolization was achieved. And a post-TACE MR done a few weeks later showed that there was actually increase in tumor size with continued hyperenhancement and delayed washout, indicating viable tumor. The mass measured about 4.9 centimeters on the MRI, and that was the one that you just saw on the previous slide. Further staging of the imaging of the chest showed no distant metastatic disease. Relevant labs, platelets were 110, albumin was 3.0. I forgot to include the bili, but the bili at the time was 2.9. So the patient was given a CP score of 7, class B. And then if you use albi, the albumin bilirubin score, it came out as an albi grade 2, which score of like negative 1.44, which is pretty close to grade 3, which is, you know, analogous to like a child C based on the albi score. So that kind of gives an indication of the overall level of liver function and degree of cirrhosis. So on this slide, I wasn't sure who was actually answering this, so I just kind of put in here, what would you recommend for this patient at this time? Host and panelists can vote. So this would be the attendees are voting, is that right?
Yes.
So please put down your options, RFA or microwave ablation, some sort of interventional ablation, further chemoembolization, resection, SBRT, or systemic therapy.
Well, while they're filling that out, I would be interested to know the panelists' thoughts on, I think, so technically a HCC that's ruptured at stage 4, I think if you read the book, does anybody treat it as such in their day-to-day practice?
So Dr. Baker said yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I said I would. I mean, it's one of those things, I don't want to jump to the answer, but it's like you look at that location, it's not a great tumor location for definitive resection. And when they've got a ruptured hepatoma, I mean, you're just really have peritoneal seeding because of the rupture. And I think they should be treated like they're stage 4. At least they ought to be treated that way for a while, you know, and I would watch to see if you have, you know, I mean, I would do a full staging workup for those guys, including bone scans and chest CT, and then watch them for a while with some form that's non-surgical, some form of non-surgical treatment, and see what you end up seeing over time, because I just think they're very, very likely to see recurrence in the peritoneum because of that rupture.
I'll wait to make more comments. I'll wait for the audience response and then we can talk more.
Okay, looks like we have the results. Can everyone see this? This popped up on my screen. I think everyone else hopefully sees it too, but looks like the largest group was SBRT at 45%. Surgical resection actually was number two at 36%. And then systemic therapy mentioned at 18%. No one chose ablation and no one chose for another round of chemoembolization. So definitely very appropriate. I mean, I obviously know what happened next. Does anyone else want to make any comments on this?
Yeah, I guess at Arts and Reward, just upfront for this patient, certainly taste is something that we would have done. And I don't know if your center's practice like this, but we've been heavily a taste followed by an ablation type of center where that ablation is either thermal ablation or SBRT. And most patients who are getting, you know, ablative liver-directed therapy are getting taste beforehand. And that's what we'd have offered. You know, given the single lesion, the history of bleeding, and the rupture, my opinion is our tumor board would have recommended local therapy like you've been doing, followed by follow-up on a systemic therapy, given the high risk of metastatic potential. So both treatments.
Okay. Any other comments?
Can you tell me again why the, you made some comment about, I think, the vascular distribution in the tumor on the initial embolization. Can you say that again, repeat that?
Yeah, so they, at the time of the taste, they, you know, as they were in there and mapping out the vessels, they found that there were multiple parasitizing vasculature that they couldn't address the tumor any further than what they did. And they were only achieved about 50%. So the other ones, they were not able to kind of feed, they were not able to, you know, get the catheter into those other vessels. And so they left it at that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it would be heavily reliant on the discussion you guys just had. You know, sometimes if somebody's bleeding, the vessels you'll take time to catheterize and treat is different than if you're bringing them back for a more elective cancer treatment. So, you know, we would probably have a close look at the angiogram, see if it's something we thought that we could treat. And what vessels were parasitizing, you know, just from my IR mind's perspective, you know, parasitizing cystic artery doesn't matter that much to me. Gallbladder is very tolerant, but, you know, at the same time, dumping things into any of the bowel is not tolerant at all. And so, you know, where they come from would end up mattering a lot. And then I think probably, we would talk a lot about local regional therapy plus systemic therapy, as was mentioned earlier. I think it would likely, if we thought the patient could tolerate it. Sounds like patient's pretty sick, but if they could tolerate, that's probably where we'd go.
Yeah, I will say at the time of presentation, although I wasn't involved in the case at the time, the patient definitely was not in good shape. But fortunately, by the time I saw her, she had bounced back quite nicely. Okay, so I guess I'll move on to kind of what we did. So next slide. So the recommendation actually wound up being to offer local therapy with radiation. That was discussed at tumor board. And interestingly, although, you know, the point's very well taken about the concern of metastatic disease, interestingly, the tumor board actually also recommended an evaluation for a liver transplant. So it was not felt to be as much of a concern, but I just wanted to, you know, bring that up. But this is from our treatment planning scan, but I'm mainly showing this at this point just to give you an idea of the full location of this lesion. You can see that it is, you know, basically at the kind of the bottom edge of that segment five. You can see how close and proximal it is to bowel. That may have involved, you know, that may have implicated where some of those parasitizing vessels may have been coming from as well. So you can see that in terms of location, you know, this gives you an idea of the challenges. So can you go back to the previous slide? I think that was where I was trying to really think about. So for those that are, you know, radiation minded, when we think about tumors that we want to treat or can treat, we, in the thinking that we always focus on, of course, would be tumor size. That's always one of the top concerns, but also tumor location, because a 5-centimeter tumor at the dome of the liver is much different than a 5-centimeter lesion that's sitting at the very bottom of the liver that's also growing out into the abdominal cavity. And then, of course, underlying liver function, because of the tolerance effects of radiation, how well can liver tolerate radiation really depends on its underlying function, child's A, child's B, or nowadays LB seems to be used more. And then, of course, with location comes adjacent critical organs. And you can see, besides liver, we actually have to really start focusing on the stomach, small bowel, large bowel. So next slide. And then this was meant to kind of show that. So that's okay. No, that's fine. It's fine. So I guess for the radiation oncologists, I guess if anyone wants to take a guess, but this was meant for the radiation oncologists in the room. But what dose and fractionation would you consider using for this lesion?
Dr. Chainweather, answering that, would you mind taking a non-radiation oncologist through your thought process in terms of margins? Because, you know, of course, we know that there's microscopic invasion of the tumor further than we can just see on the imaging. And so what kind of margin, so to speak, do you guys try to get?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think in my mind, the way I think about it is, there's kind of there's sort of the well encapsulated HCCs where you can really see nice margins and, you know, tends to be better differentiated. And then there's the more diffuse infiltrative type where the margins become much more blurred. I would say, generally speaking, the outcomes of the diffuse ones, as we all know, is much worse. And so I tend to use much larger margins. Just one is in terms of how I contour, I just contour bigger. So when I'm drawing the tumors, I just use really wide brush strokes. And then I may or may not add sort of an additional, I mean, some studies have suggested anywhere between a half a centimeter, maybe up to a centimeter, that there may be microscopic disease extension. Whereas if it's well differentiated, I tend actually not to use a margin, partly because, you know, the borders tend to be more well-defined, but also in radiation, you know, in addition to our gross disease volume that we draw, the volume of the tumor, we always routinely add a margin beyond that, anywhere between 3 millimeters, 5 millimeters, in some cases up to a centimeter already. And that's really to account for what we call setup uncertainty, day-to-day variation type of thing. And then beyond that, radiation is, it's not like it's an all or none where the dose only goes to the tumor and nowhere else. There's this, you know, at the edges, periphery around, there's something called penumbra, which is basically generally higher doses of radiation, not quite as high as the prescription dose, but, you know, it falls off. And so there is some penumbra effect that we think can treat some of that micrometastatic disease that extends beyond the tumor. So my practice in general is that unless it's a diffuse infiltrative, I usually don't add a microscopic disease margin, but I will always add what we call a planning target volume margin for setup uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, you hit all exactly. I mean, I was hoping you were going to get to the dose fall off at the periphery of the PTV, but that's exactly right. You know, HCC is radio sensitive, and the thought is that the dose that's slightly less than the prescription dose that's landing in the, you know, the margins around what we've delineated the tumor is probably sufficient to take care of that microscopic disease in the periphery. And, you know, our long-term control data, you know, points to that point as well.
Yeah, but it's a great question. Okay. So looking at the, hopefully everyone can see the results here. Wow. The group is definitely more aggressive than I am. And so for those that are not radiation oncologists, we use stereotactic body radiotherapy, at least I do. There are other ways that you can give high dose radiation that can be non-stereotactic body radiotherapy. And all SBRT means is you're giving it in basically 5 fractions or less. That's a billing definition of what SBRT is, because as you all know, we can all just dial up or dial down the number of fractions we want to give. So there's just a sharp line to define what SBRT is. So in this case, the more you fractionate, the more fractions you use, generally the thought is that it's safer in terms of normal tissue complications. And of course, the ones we're worried about are things like liver and the bowel. So because this tumor is so close to bowel, I automatically am thinking 5 fractions right away. Generally speaking, because the tumor is so close to bowel, I was and for the reasons that the patient is a child's B in an ALBI grade 2, I was thinking in the range of 40 gray or less in five fractions. So I chose the fourth option.
Yeah, that's what I would do as well. I mean, I would even potentially even dose de-escalate the margin of the PTV right on the stomach as well, and do some dose painting and potentially make the plane a little bit cooler on that interface with the stomach as well. But, you know, with the ALBI-B, you know, the Chalcipute B plus, I certainly, you know, wouldn't go higher than 40 again with the knowledge that HCC is radio sensitive.
Right. So actually, so there's even more of a twist to it than this. So, okay. So next slide, please. I forgot what I said here. Okay. Yeah. So this was the plan that we came up with. This was initial plan planned at 40 grain, five fractions. Now, you know, I recently moved to the University of Michigan, you know, when in Rome. So, you know, they started this adaptive protocol where actually they showed that because when you have patients with fraught liver function, there's an adaptive way to do it where you give three fractions of radiotherapy, you wait a month and give the patient a break and you let the liver function sort itself out. So if there's any signs of liver function decline after 1 month, then the plan is to not give the remaining two fractions. But if the liver function holds steady, then you would complete the treatment with the remaining two fractions. And so, you know, after talking with my colleagues there, the liver experts that I work with now at Michigan, because of the patient's fraught liver status, we thought this might be a good case example of someone to try an adaptive approach. So we looked at 40 and the 40, honestly, can you go to the next slide? I think that might've showed the DVH. So this worried me a little bit because what I didn't show you was that the liver volume was actually on the smaller side, less than 1,000 cc's. The mean liver dose was an 11. The volume spared 15 gray was barely 700 cc's. I also look at volume spared 7 gray, which I try to keep above 500, and this was 470. You can see that the bowel, the duodenum and stomach dose constraints were more than I would like. I try to keep the V33 less than 1 cc. The stomach was 42. Despite my best ability to try to keep the dose cold along that interface, like Nima said, you can see that the purple being the PTV, you can see it's already cold along that edge, and I still was not able to meet my dose constraints. So we chose to go to 35 and 5 and drop the dose down. And I think if you go to the next slide, that may show the dose constraints. Okay, no. So what I'm showing here is this is the data from the Michigan adaptive approach where they used actually this ICG, this Indocyanine in green, as a way to measure liver function. That part they don't really use anymore. They use ALBI. But the point is that they took these patients and then they basically did what we said, three treatments, 1 month break, and then they would re-ICG assess the liver function. If there was a steady function, they would complete the treatment. If there was a liver function decline, they would not give the remaining two fractions. Next slide. So this showed that overall that treatment was very well tolerated. Liver toxicity was defined as two or more points increase in CP score. That the rate of that happening was only 7%, but the local control rates still maintained very high rates at 99% at 1 year, 95% at 2 years. This addressed the question of whether it's safe to wait a month between fractions. And based on this data, it seemed that it was. Next slide. So then this was the dose fraction. This was the DVH. For 35 gray and five, I was able to meet my dose constraints better. And we went with this plan. And so we were giving three fractions now, and then we are going to wait a month, and then we're going to decide whether or not to give the remaining two fractions. I think that might be my last slide, but go ahead one more. Oh yeah, so that this just says what I just said in written form.
Yeah, that was the last slide. Yeah, I think that was a really interesting case. You know, a nice approach to discuss to the adaptive, you know, technique. I think that's, you know, something that we've actually talked a little bit about doing it at UNC. I think we've tried it on one or two patients to my knowledge, but I haven't been on the GI service in a little while. So.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Chang. Great case. Mine will be pretty short. It's really an evaluation of when you should treat and when you should not treat. And I think we know one of the most challenging things to learn as you're going through training and early practice is when to say no to a treatment, when you feel like the toxicity and risk of the treatment might be greater than the benefits. And I think this is an illustrative example of that. So can move forward, please. 72-year-old man, COPD, diabetes. He's got a Chalcipute A, HCV cirrhosis, and had been undergoing HCC screening with AFP and abdominal ultrasounds every 6 months per the American Association of Liver Disease recommendations. And he was found to have a hypodense left liver lesion with a normal AFP that was further followed up with multi-phase imaging, identifying a small segment 2 LIRAS5 HCC. You see there with the faint yellow arrow, somewhere in the range of 2 by 2 centimeters. He was presented a tumor board, you know, with a cirrhosis and thrombocytopenia in the 70,000 range. He was thought to not be the best surgical candidate. Also wasn't a great transplant candidate as well, given age and other psychosocial situations. So the plan for him was to consider him for local regional therapy. And at OHSU, like I mentioned previously, we've for the longest time have approached these patients with a kind of a bimodality approach with TACE followed by a type of ablation, and that ablation either being thermal ablation or SBRT in situations when that makes sense. And for this small lesion, I mean, certainly size-wise, it's IR felt it was certainly doable as far as thermal ablation goes, but they had some hesitancy in relation to the proximity to the heart. And I'd like to hear Dr. Young's take on this. You know, when you see a lesion in this location, you're thinking of thermal ablation. What kind of approach, what do you think about, and are there any approaches where you could think thermal ablation could be safe?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is a frequently debated question in the halls of IR, I guess, for lack of a better word. You know, there are a few retrospective papers that have shown that even lesions which look for all purposes to be touching the heart, although we know they're not actually, are safe to thermally ablate. Just for everybody, I'm sure all of you guys know this, but the things that are kind of running through my IR mind when I'm thinking about ablating a lesion like this is I don't want to damage the diaphragm. In reality, I can't damage the heart. The heat sink is too much, but I can damage the myocardium and cause a myocardial perfusion. So those are kind of the things. I personally and my practices tend to be fairly aggressive ablationist. So we would have ablated something like this. Typically, positioning is the key to it. You just need to get them in a little bit of Trendelenburg and float some fluid down there. But it's certainly a widely debated topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was debated for sure. And, you know, a healthy conversation, a decision from our tumor board was for this gentleman to proceed with TACE followed by a consolidated SBRT. The next slide. So that's the day of TACE, CT without contrast showing the distribution of the ethidol. And normally we wait, you know, a handful of weeks between the TACE procedure and CT simulation, largely to allow the ethidol in the uninvolved liver to be taken up by the liver macrophages so that we can really, really delineate our tumor volume. And you can see the CT simulation at 4 weeks post-TACE really nicely represents real dense, very dense ethidol uptake where that lesion was and a largely a resolution of the ethidol and the rest of the rough liver. If you could click one more slide, you kind of see the proximity of that TACE uptake to the right coronary artery right there. And I, as well as a lot of radiation oncologists I know, are very commonly quite hesitant to deliver large hypofractionated doses on the coronary artery. I mean, there's really no strong data as far as I know that shows a high level of toxicity, but it certainly is a concern of ours. And in practice, we kind of rarely do it. And given the proximity of the right coronary artery to the lesion that had been TACE, it certainly would have been within our planning treatment volume. This patient was simulated with a breath hold technique, but still it would have been in the prescription dose and it would have received a sizable amount of radiation. So, you know, I had this conversation with the patient after the TACE and let them know my concerns. And, you know, I was thankful that the TACE procedure seemed to be a robust, you know, dense uptake. This was a contrast enhanced scan as well. And there was no surrounding arterial enhancement outside of that ethidol uptake. So we elected to proceed with the TACE alone approach. And I've been following him every 3 months. And if you click on the next slide, he's 15 months out now, and he's got no residual or recurrent disease, no new lesions, no arterial enhancement around that taste lesion, and we're following him along. And, you know, potentially if he has a recurrence, I'll present a tumor board to figure out what to do next, which will, you know, at our center, probably start with the taste first.
Just out of curiosity, is it typical in your center to follow taste cases with CT versus MRI?
Commonly CT, yeah, commonly CT. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see any plus minuses?
I think there is some limited data to suggest that MRI is more sensitive, especially in the taste where you have that hard. I mean, whoever did this taste did an amazing job. They get really dense staining of the lipidol, which is a positive sign. But in this particular case, it's really hard because we also know that MRI struggles at the top of the liver, particularly in the right dome, but, you know, right next to the heart with that inherent motion. We do know it has some struggles there.
Gotcha. Thank you. Great. Yeah, I mean, that's the rest of this case. I mean, really, I just wanted to kind of make it clear to the team here that, you know, with our HCC patients, there's a menu of treatment options available. And rather than really trying to, you know, make something work that may not work, to really kind of lean back to your colleagues, represent a tumor board, take a measured approach, because there could be another modality that is just as good that can give them control.
Yeah, that's a great case. I'm sorry if I missed it, but what was the dose you gave, and what was the dose constraint you used?
Oh yeah, so no, we elected to defer any consolidated radiation.
Oh,
so
okay.
So yeah, I was very hesitant to do so given the proximity of the right coronary artery. Would have you know, I'm not sure if I would have ever treated this patient.
Would you have treated? That's a good question.
I don't think so. I'm the one following him, and whenever he has a recurrence, I'm gonna send him back to IR. I think that's how it's gonna work for this guy.
Yeah, that's an excellent case.
Dr. Baker, can I ask one question about that last case?
Yeah.
The thing that comes to my mind is the question about whether or not you need the chemo in the EMBO, or if is it just the ischemic effect of the EMBO that's helped you out with this tumor. And I guess I also wonder about the utility of CERT, you know, because CERT will give you the radiation effect that you're talking about using in a consolidated way, just with the, you know, the initial embolization. I mean, is Y90 something that you all are using, and is it something you consider in this case, and why or why not, bring it to this particular patient?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with our center. I mean, we certainly are doing a lot of Y90 segmentectomies, you know, selective Y90s. In situations where lesions are small like this and amenable to either combined modality taste thermal ablation or taste SBRT, that's typically our approach. You know, for larger tumors, you know, larger than 4 centimeters, we're certainly talking about Y90 versus SBRT. And as all you guys know, there's always healthy debate in our tumor boards regarding the ideal modality in those situations.
And is there a rationale for that? Like in terms of why small tumors taste and large, I mean, larger tumors tear makes a lot of sense to me, because you get a lot less post-embolization syndrome, and it's very effective, I think, for larger tumors, and you can do it multiple times. You know, so do tear for the.
Yeah, I mean, I think our tumor board is falling on the length and robustness of data with thermal ablation for the larger tumors for sure, and our institutional experience and positive experience of SBRT for these smaller tumors. I mean, SBRT. It's still a very localized therapy, and for these small lesions, it's an excellent modality. But you know, there certainly is variations in practice, and you know, we need more data.
Yeah,
I agree, we need more data. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, I would just say I think some people would argue that in sub-3 centimeter HCCs, there's a number of randomized controlled trials. They are out of Asia to show that ablation is equivalent to surgical resection in sub-3 centimeters and sub. And so I think some centers would argue, hey, maybe we don't need the tape. Maybe if we thought it was thermally ablatable, we could just go ahead and thermally ablate a 2 centimeter HCC.
Yeah, I agree. Ablation is a good option for these smaller tumors too, and it's pretty simple, you know, pretty easy.
All right, thank you guys.
So I feel bad. I don't have as cool a question. So you guys are just going to have to listen to me verbally ask you questions. So this is a case of a 73-year-old patient that shows up with a massive HCC. Unfortunately, here in Arizona, we have a number of patients that don't receive as good of preventive care, I guess I would say, as we would hope. And so this is not uncommon for us to see 30 AFP of 3,500. T-Billy's 1.1, he actually came to us because he was told he had no options. I will say this gentleman was 73, but looked pretty young. ECOG 0, he was still working. So here's our pre-treatment imaging. I think if you press, it should just play for us. I hope it plays for us.
Let's try one more time.
No,
looks like not.
I apologize.
It was working.
Maybe
outside
if you hover on the image, you might see a play button, but
yeah, that's what I'm trying now.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
So it's a approximately 12 centimeter HCC with portal vein tumor thrombus. The portal vein tumor thrombus extended to the right portal vein, but not the main portal vein. So while Jacob kindly works and sees if he can get my MRI to play, I would love to talk with the panelists about portal vein tumor thrombus, how, like when those discussions happen at tumor board, how closely is it looked at, whether it's, you know, just a segmental branch, a right or left portal branch, main portal branch. I'd love to hear you guys' local takes on how you approach those patients.
I mean, I guess I'll try to say something intelligible here, because I mean, usually from our point of view, so generally speaking, you know, we usually kind of see those as sort of radioembo cases unless otherwise specified. That's usually how my institutions have operated. I can't say too much about whether it's you know, segmental versus main branch or something like that. What we usually try to parse out is, you know, separating tumor from bland thrombus, and then usually radioembo is done. But if for whatever reason radioembo cannot be done, then it becomes a question of like a TACE plus or minus a SBRT type of approach that we've done in our, you know, at least at my old institution, I should say. Oftentimes the portal, the tumor thrombus is TACE, and then we usually would follow that up with SBRT after the fact. I think there's pretty good data on, you know, aggressive local therapy involving radiation in patients with tumor thrombus as well. It's a randomized trial from Korea that showed, you know, improved survival over just systemic therapy. But otherwise, you know, we usually think of it more as, I think of it more as an IR disease, IR situation.
I don't know if it's going to play, but I just one other question. Does anybody have you guys ever, let's say the patient gets Y90, has a good response, but you have that nugget hanging out in the portal vein of tumor that happens to you sometimes. Is that a case that you guys at your tumor board would talk about then going back and treating with SBRT?
I have done that. Yes, I've done that on occasion. Sometimes it's TACE and then SBRT, or sometimes we just go straight to SBRT.
Yeah, but the data we utilize is actually Dr. Chang's data to support that approach. So yeah. So, I mean, so really if the tumor volume is small, it's safe. Certainly, you know, we wouldn't want to go back and treat a large volume after a large volume Y90, but confined volumes for sure.
Right. Confined just to like that little nugget of thrombus that you mentioned.
All right. Unfortunately, I apologize because I don't know if the MRI is going to play. Is it going to just play?
Yeah, I don't think I can get it to play. Unfortunately, I've tried exiting out of the PowerPoint and a couple of things, but.
All right. Well, let's see if the mapping Andrew Graham will play.
Oh, that's playing. Or something.
No, I think it's just fading in.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. Well, what you would see on these is that the tumor is big and hypervascular, just as you would expect. And then this is our post-delivery SPECT CT. And what it shows is good uptake in the tumor. In particular, I just want to call out for IRs. When we see portal vein tumor thrombus, what we have learned is that we really need to focus hard on getting a good amount of dose into the actual tumor thrombus. It's not enough just to treat only the parenchymal disease. And so you'll commonly see, I'm sure, at all your institutions, your IR colleagues spending quite a bit of time in perhaps injecting fairly small arteries just to attempt to get a good dose in the portal vein tumor thrombus itself. This one did show it. So treated with Y90, anybody want to do anything else for this patient at this point? And we have 3 minutes. So I'm specifically saying, would any of you guys go ahead and jump to systemic therapy as well? Admittedly, lack of data.
Yeah, I mean, our tumor board routinely sets up a medical oncology appointment after local regional therapy for lesions like this. I can't tell you regarding the hit rate of how many patients actually proceed with systemic therapy, but it's hands down always a conversation with the patient.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we would send them for systemic therapy. Then there's other factors, you know, patient robustness, et cetera, that may determine if they get it. But I think we would at least want to consider systemic.
Yeah, I think there's no question that it would happen in our centers too. It's, you know, the guys with the portal venous involvement just have a very poor prognosis. And I think we tend to bring whatever we can to try to impact the disease.
Yeah, that's great to hear. We feel exactly the same. I couldn't agree more with what you said, Nima. Sometimes the patients don't get it for whatever reason, but pretty much all of them will get at least referred to medical oncology to have an informed discussion about it. So next slide, I don't know if this one will play either. But basically what it shows is excellent result. You guys never got to see the main tumor, so I guess you'll just take my word for it. That was a good result. So I apologize about that. We have 1 minute left. I do just have one more slide. Do you want to go forward? This is a big trial for us. This is the DosiSphere trial. And basically, you guys will probably all laugh at us later, but what it showed is that if, as interventional radiologists, we spend more time doing what you guys in radiation oncology do a lot, which is considering dose and being thoughtful about how much dose we give and where we give it, patients have much better outcomes, which I'm sure to you guys seem like saying the sky is blue and water is wet, but you know, IRs, we take a minute to learn things.
I'll send this to my IR colleagues. Great. I'm sure they're all aware of it.
I certainly hope so. I'm sure they will be.
We should do a similar study, Nima, about like the time spent treatment contouring volumes and, you know, treatment planning and see if that improves outcome.
Right. How much you interpolate?
Right. Great case.
Yeah. I think we're right at 4 o'clock here. I'll open the floor one last time for any questions. I don't see anything in the chat from our audience, but if the panelists have any other parting comments or words of wisdom, feel free.
Just HCC is a multidisciplinary disease. Make use of tumor boards and your colleagues and, you know, everything. All the options are on the table, and it just, you know, and everything has its place. So, you know, work very closely with your colleagues. It's the only thing I could really say.
I would certainly support that. And the other thing I would just say is there's a lot of cases that maybe you feel like you know what the tumor board's going to say, but the discussion is often beneficial. And there's a certain percentage of those cases you think you know that people are going to have very intelligent comments that's going to help guide care.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you all. This is excellent. Great variety of cases. I'm sure everyone watching today learned something. This was great.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Bye.
Thank you.